You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part one of a series in the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now, Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and, if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labour, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labour in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labour, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." We'll pause there at the end of chapter 1. Now, this series will assume that you're familiar with Genesis. If not, you can listen to the series that I did some time ago in the book of Genesis. But really, Exodus is continuing on with the story that ends back in chapter 50 of Genesis. There we see how God delivered his people through Joseph. And Joseph was able to rescue the 11 brothers and his father, Jacob, or Israel, as his name was changed to by God. He was able to rescue them because God brought him through very difficult circumstances where his brothers tried to sell him into slavery. God brought him to a position of authority in Egypt that meant he was able both to rescue Egypt, and by rescuing Egypt, by his planning for famine, to rescue his own people who came for refuge there. Now again in Genesis, it's very interesting that Joseph is the focus of the last part of the story of Genesis. Joseph's sons are Manasseh and Ephraim, and they become significant tribes, particularly Ephraim, within the nation of Israel that's descended from Joseph. But of course, in the blessings that God, or that Jacob gives rather, to his sons towards the end of Genesis, it's Judah who is singled out as the one who will be king, as the one whose family will produce kings. The scepter will not depart from Judah. So there's this tension, if you like, in the story between the descendants of Joseph, the descendants of Ephraim, and the descendants of Judah, and that that tension will arise later on whenever the people enter into the land that God is going to give them. It's an important part of the story of the Old Testament. But this chapter begins and ends with the idea of family. The family of Jacob and the family of his sons enter into Egypt, and we're told that there are 70 of them in total. Now that number is significant in a sense, because right back at the beginning of Genesis, or towards the beginning of Genesis, we read about 70 nations that were descended from the sons of Noah in Genesis chapter 10. And so just in the same sense that there are 70 nations descended from from Noah. So there were 70 individuals descended from Jacob. This is a small clan of people who come in with these 12 brothers and their wives and their children. And of course, they might have had servants with them as well. So it's a sizable number of people who come into Egypt. And of course, Joseph and his brothers die, verse 6 tells us. But the Israelites continue on. They're very fruitful. They multiply greatly and they increase in number and they fill the land. That again is an echo of Genesis. Back in Genesis 1, verse 27 to 28, God speaks to the human beings that he's created and he tells them to go forth and multiply. And again in Genesis 9, after the flood, that's what they're told to do. So here are the Israelites, in a sense, continuing the story of creation. Now the story that in the beginning of Genesis had looked at the whole world right up until the time of the Tower of Babel. It's the whole of mankind that is in view. Now it is the nation of Israel who are very specially in view, but they are fulfilling their part of fulfilling God's command to mankind, multiplying greatly and filling the land, just as the humankind was told to fill the earth. But a new king arises in Egypt. Joseph means nothing to him. Of course, Joseph had favour with the Pharaoh in the time of Genesis. He rose to that position of being the right-hand man of Pharaoh. And here the Pharaoh, the new Pharaoh, arises. We don't know whether it's a descendant of that original Pharaoh or whether it's a new dynasty that comes to power. Of course, there were a number of different dynasties in Egypt. Now, scholars, of course, try to reconcile the dates of the Bible with the dates of Egyptian history. And there is a mainstream view on that, which actually really discredits the biblical account, suggests that the Bible has exaggerated certain figures and so on. But there's a very plausible, or what I understand to be a very plausible alternative, that's promoted by a man called David Rohl, R-O-H-L, which suggests that actually the reason the two don't seem to fit together is because of the way people are calculating the dates of the Egyptian pharaohs. But when you calculate, when you realise that some of their rules overlapped with each other, you end up with a different time frame, which does fit the biblical account. Now, that's beyond the purpose and the remit of this study, where I'm looking at the text of Exodus. But it's just worth mentioning that. In any case, the new pharaoh arises. And this pharaoh is shrewd. He sees the Israelites and he's concerned about their numbers. He wants to deal shrewdly with them in case their numbers increase to a point where they might join the enemies. That again suggests that this might be a new dynasty that has come to power. Their position is vulnerable. They're not yet established, and so they're afraid of anybody who might support their opponents. And the fear is that they will join the enemies, they'll fight against them and leave the country. So it's not just the fear of what they might do in overthrowing this new king, but also what it might do to Egypt if such a large number of people left. The Egyptian economy is becoming dependent upon the Israelites. They've prospered, they've increased, they're a significant part of the nation. And so this pharaoh comes up with a plan. He puts slave masters over the Israelites. They are forced into labour and they build cities, store cities for Pharaoh, Pithom and Ramesses. Again, people have tried to find these cities and to locate them. It's probably not easy to do that. But this reads as the account of somebody who knows the history that he's talking about, doesn't it? And of course, we receive these first five books of the Bible as the books of Moses. Moses is going to become the major character from the book of Exodus right through to the end of Deuteronomy. Genesis has laid the foundation for understanding God's purposes for the world and the entry of sin into the world. And then also God's calling of Abraham and his family and that covenant that God has made with him. But now the Israelites are at the mercy of Pharaoh. They're oppressed. But the more they're oppressed, the more they multiply and spread, verse 12 says. That, again, finds an echo in the book of Acts in the New Testament as the church faces oppression and opposition from powers that are hostile to God, and yet God prospers them and they multiply as the word of God goes forth. Just worth noticing that parallel. But the Egyptians begin to dread the Israelites, and so they work them even harder. They make their work difficult with harsh labour and brick and mortar and all kinds of work in the fields. They work them ruthlessly, verse 14 says. Here is the story of slavery and of oppression, the abuse of an ethnic minority. It's a story that runs through human history. As in every generation and in every part of the world, there have been imperial powers and there have been those weak nations that end up subject to the oppressors. It's not the last time in their history that Israel will be subject to stronger powers around them. At this point in history, Egypt is the dominant power in the Near East or Middle East. There are also powers that are present up in Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq and modern-day Iran and so on, but they're not as powerful as Egypt. They'll rise onto the world stage a little bit later on. So the Egyptians are the superpower. The Israelites are at their mercy. Slaves, oppressed, in bondage. But you'll notice that there's no mention here of them calling out to God. There's no mention of them turning to him for delivery, and as we get on into the book, we'll see that this is the problem. They've forgotten God. They've neglected him. But God hasn't forgotten them. And so these midwives come into the story in verse 15, Shiphrah and Puah. The king of Egypt gives them a command that they're to kill the baby boys. Girls can live. It's not a complete annihilation of the Israelites that he has in mind. We've seen already that their numbers are important within the population of Egypt. But if all the boys are wiped out, the girls, of course, will be forced to marry non-Israelites. And that's the path to assimilation. When God gives his law later on in Exodus, it's going to be important that the nation don't intermarry with the worshippers of other gods. That's a path to losing their distinctiveness. It's not a sort of racism in the sense of an ethnic superiority, but actually it's a religious commitment. It's a commitment to God that means they must not intermarry. And so the writing is on the wall, if you like, for the Israelites. But these midwives were told, fear God. It's the first time that God is mentioned in this book. Here are these two women who are held up as the example of faithfulness. Amidst a nation who don't appear to be crying out to God, these women remember God and they fear God. And the fear of the Lord, the fear of God, of course, is the beginning of all wisdom. According to the wisdom books, it's there in the Psalms and in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Wisdom begins with fearing God. To fear God is not to be afraid of God as if he is unpredictable or can't be trusted, or we're supposed to run around on tiptoes trying not to offend him. But the fear of God means holy reverence for God, means recognizing that he is the highest authority, the true authority. And so they know that God's authority must be obeyed, and not the Egyptians, not the king of the Egyptians, not Pharaoh. Now think about that calculation that's going on in their heads. Here is Pharaoh who has the power to take their lives. Here is Pharaoh who is oppressing their people. Here is Pharaoh, the head of the superpower. And yet they calculate this and say, no, God is a higher authority and we're more concerned about God's judgment rather than the judgment of Pharaoh. And so we will do what is right. And they refuse to kill these boys. They let them live. They fear God. You know, we live in an age when the fear of God might lead us to the same kind of submission and yet resistance to the authorities. Notice how these women still subject themselves to the king. They don't become insurrectionists or rebels. They submit themselves to his judgment. But they refuse to do this immoral, sinful thing that he has asked them to do. And that's how Christians ought to live in the world that we live in today. We submit to the authorities, and yet we fear God. And so if those two are in conflict, like these midwives, or like Peter and John speaking to the Sanhedrin in the book of Acts, we say we have to fear God rather than men, and so we serve God and we do what God wants rather than what people are asking us to do. For Peter and John, that meant they would not stop preaching about Jesus. For these midwives, it means they wouldn't end the lives of the babies. You can parallel that, of course, to the modern midwifery profession and the care of the unborn child, perhaps, and provision of abortion, something which is horrific and sinful in the eyes of God, ending the lives of innocents. Well, these two women take their stand and they risk losing their jobs, but God preserves them. The king summons them and asks for an explanation, and they, well, we presume verse 19 is a lie, perhaps it's true, but it seems that it's a story that they tell to explain the phenomenon. We're not told whether that is acceptable or not. A lie is never right, of course. But there are situations, and this is one example of it, and another might be in the book of Joshua, whenever Rahab lies about having hidden the spies, that the greater good is to tell that untruth, to tell that lie in order to preserve the life of people who would otherwise be killed. It doesn't make the lie right, but it does make it acceptable, because the person that the lie is told to doesn't deserve the truth. That's an interesting ethical issue, but it's just important to say that this is not endorsing lying, but it is recognizing the realities of life. And the reality that preserving life is a higher calling and a higher standard. Now again, we don't know if these are the only two midwives. It seems unlikely that such a large number of people would only have two. Perhaps there were other midwives who went along with Pharaoh and did what he asked. Perhaps there were others who were resisted. But we have the names of these two women, Shiphrah and Puah, told to us. And God is kind to them, verse 20 says, and the people increase and become more numerous, and because they feared God, he gave them families of their own. Now, of course, we can't generalize from that. This is not saying that everybody who fears God will overcome barrenness or will be blessed with many children. But in this situation, God honors these women who have honored him. And he does that through preserving their bloodline. He does it through preserving their lives, and also the lives of their children. These Israelites are unstoppable, or rather God is unstoppable. God is not going to allow his people to be wiped out, to lose their identity, to be assimilated amongst the Egyptians. He's going to preserve them, and he's going to do it through ordinary people at this stage doing ordinary jobs. You notice that we haven't got on to the great hero Moses. There's nothing supernatural going on here in a sense, nothing dramatic, none of the big miracles, the parting of the Red Sea. It's just ordinary people in a difficult situation being faithful to God, having children, raising them to fear God, not giving up hope, not giving in to despair, not allowing the knowledge of God to be lost in the case of these midwives. That's often the way God works, you know. We shouldn't underestimate the power and the impact and the influence of ordinary people, and especially when those ordinary Christians who fear God and who live for them become parents who raise children with those same values, like Puah and Shiphrah did. Shiphrah. How we parent our children, how we raise them in the fear of God with a distinctive lifestyle, demonstrating to them the reality that Pharaoh is not the ultimate authority, God is. And Pharaoh, in your situation, may be all sorts of authorities who are over you. But then Pharaoh gives the order to all his people, every Hebrew boy that is born must be thrown into the Nile, but let every girl live. He continues with his plan to get rid of the boys, the males, amongst the Hebrews, amongst the Israelites. Hebrew, of course, is the term that comes from, I think it's the grandfather of Abraham, Eber. I gave his name to that wider family of peoples, and the Israelites are those specifically descended from Jacob, and through him from Isaac and from Abraham. The throwing into the Nile, that's to be the way of execution, quite possibly seen as not just an execution but an offering to the gods of the Egyptians, because that great river Nile was the source of life for Egypt, as it still is today. It's the source of water that irrigates. If you see a satellite map of Egypt, you'll see this green line running along the Nile and spreading out at the north as the river spreads out into a great delta that enters into the Mediterranean. And on either side of that strip of green is yellow sand, desert. The Nile, the great life-giving force, and so associated with the gods of Egypt and the worship of those gods. So here is the setting that is painted for us. A nation under oppression, a nation who don't seem to be crying out collectively to God, and yet within that nation we have these two women held out, as women so often are in the scriptures, I think of the Gospels too, as the prime examples of faithfulness, of God-fearing living. God blessing his people despite the opposition, but this very real threat that Pharaoh presents.